Before we started, Pietrov told me naively that I should have a front place partly because I should subscribe more. There was no fixed price of admission. Everyone gave what he could or what he wanted to. When the plate was taken round, almost everyone put something in it, even if it were only a halfpenny. But if I were given a front place, partly on account of money, on the supposition that I should give more than others, what a sense of their own dignity there was in that again. You are richer than I am, so you can stand in front, and though we are all equal, you'll give more. And so a spectator like you is more pleasing to the actors. You must have the first place, for we are all here not for the money, but for respect, so we ought to sort ourselves of our own accord. How much fine and genuine pride there is in this. It is a respect not for money, but respect for oneself. As a rule, there was not much respect for money, for wealth in the prison, especially if one looks at convicts without distinction as a gang in the mass. I can't remember one of them seriously demeaning himself for the sake of money. There were men who were always begging, who begged even from me, but this was mischief, roguery, rather than the real thing. There was too much humour and naivete in it. I don't know whether I express myself so as to be understood. But I am forgetting the theatricals. To return. Till the curtain was raised, the whole room was a strange and animated picture. To begin with, masses of spectators crowded, squeezed tightly, packed on all sides, waiting with patient and blissful faces for the performance to begin. In the back rows, men were clambering on one another. Many of them had brought blocks of wood from the kitchen. Fixing the thick block of wood against the wall, a man would climb onto it, leaning with both hands on the shoulders of someone in front of him, and would stand like that, without changing his attitude, for the whole 2 hours, perfectly satisfied with himself and his position. Others got their feet on the lower step of the stove, and stayed this way all the time, leaning on men in front of them. This was in the rows furthest back, next to the wall. At the sides, too, men were standing on the bed in dense masses above the musicians. This was a good place. 5 people had clambered onto the stove itself, and lying on it, looked down from it. They must have been blissful. The window sills on the opposite wall were also crowded with people who had come in late or failed to get a good place. Everyone behaved quietly and decorously. Everyone wished to show himself in the best light before the gentry and the officers. All faces expressed a simple-hearted expectation. Every face was red and bathed in sweat from the closeness and heat. A strange light of childlike joy, of pure, sweet pleasure, was shining on these lined and branded brows and cheeks, on those faces usually so morose and gloomy, in those eyes which sometimes gleamed with such terrible fire. They were all bareheaded, and all the heads were shaven on the right side. Suddenly, sounds of bustle and hurrying were heard on the stage. In a minute, the curtain would rise. Then the band struck up. This band deserves special mention. 8 musicians were installed on the bed on one side. 2 violins, one from the prison and one borrowed from someone in the fortress, but both the fiddlers were convicts. 3 balalaikas, all homemade. 2 guitars, and a tambourine instead of a double bass. The violins simply scraped and squealed. The guitars were wretched, but the balalaikas were wonderful. The speed with which they twanged the strings with their fingers was a positive feat of agility. They played dance tunes. At the liveliest part of the tunes, the balalaika players would tap the case of the instruments with their knuckles. The tone, the taste, the execution, the handling of the instrument, and the characteristic rendering of the tune, all was individual, original, and typical of the convicts. One of the guitarists, too, played his instrument splendidly. This was the gentleman who had murdered his father. As for the tambourine, it was simply marvellous. The player whirled it round on his finger and drew his thumb across the surface. Now we heard rapid, resonant, monotonous taps. Then suddenly this loud, distinct sound seemed to be broken into a shower of innumerable jangling and whispering notes. 2 accordions also appeared on the scene. Upon my word, I had no idea till then what could be done with simple peasant instruments. The blending and harmony of sounds, above all the spirit, the character of the understanding, and rendering of the tune in its very essence were simply amazing. For the first time, I fully appreciated all the reckless dash and gaiety of the gay, dashing Russian dance songs. At last, the curtain rose. There was a general stir. Everyone shifted from one leg to the other. Those at the back stood on tiptoe. Someone fell off his block of wood. Everyone, without exception, opened his mouth and stared, and absolute silence reigned. The performance began. Allais was standing near me in a group consisting of his brothers and all the other Circassians. They were all intensely delighted with the performance and came every evening afterwards. All the Muslims, Tatars, and others, as I have noticed more than once, are passionately fond of spectacles of all sorts. Next to them, Isai Fomich had tucked himself in. From the moment the curtain rose, he seemed to be all ears and eyes, in simple-hearted, greedy expectation of delights and marvels. It would have been pitiful indeed if he had been disappointed. Allais's charming face beamed with such pure, childlike joy that I must confess I felt very happy looking at him, and I remember that at every amusing and clever sally on the part of the actors, when there was a general burst of laughter, I could not help turning to Allais and glancing at his face. He did not see me. He had no attention to spare for me. On the left side, quite near me, stood an old convict who was always scowling, discontented and grumbling. He, too, noticed Allais, and I saw him more than once turn with a half-smile towards him. He was so charming. Allais Semyonich, he called him. I don't know why. They began with Filatka and Miroshka. Filatka, acted by Balushkin, was really splendid. He played his part with amazing precision. One could see that he had thought out every phrase, every movement. Into the slightest word or gesture, he knew how to put value and significance in perfect harmony with the character he was acting. And to this conscientious effort and study must be added an inimitable gaiety, simplicity, and naturalness. If you had seen Baklushin, you would certainly have agreed that he was a born actor of real talent. I had seen Filatka more than once at theatres in Moscow and Petersburg, and I can say positively that the city actors were inferior to Baklushin in the part of Filatka. By comparison with him, they were too much like peasants and not real Russian peasants. They were too anxious to mimic the Russian peasant. Baklushin was stirred too by rivalry. Everyone knew that in the second play, the part of Kedril would be taken by the convict Potsekin, who was for some reason considered by everyone to be a more talented actor than Baklushin. And at this, Baklushin was as annoyed as a child. How often he had come to me during those last few days to give vent to his feelings. 2 hours before the performance, he was in a perfect fever. When they laughed and shouted to him from the crowd, "Bravo, Baklushin! First rate!" his whole face beamed with pleasure. There was a light of real inspiration in his eyes. The scene of his kissing Miroshka, when Filatka shouts to him beforehand, "Wipe your nose," and wipes his own, was killingly funny. Everyone was rocking with laughter. But what interested me more than anything was the audience. They were all completely carried away. They gave themselves up to their pleasure without reserve. Shouts of approbation sounded more and more frequently. One would nudge his neighbour and hurriedly whisper his impressions, without caring or even noticing who was beside him. Another would turn ecstatically to the audience at an amusing passage, hurriedly look at everyone, wave his hand as though calling on everyone to laugh, and immediately turn greedily round to the stage again. Another one simply clicked with his fingers and his tongue and could not stand still, but being unable to move from his place, kept shifting from one leg to the other. By the end of the performance, the general gaiety had reached its height. I am not exaggerating anything. Imagine prison, fetters, bondage, the vista of melancholy years ahead, the life of days as monotonous as the drip of water on a dull autumn day, and suddenly all these oppressed and outcast men are allowed for one short hour to relax, to rejoice, to forget the weary dream, to create a complete theatre, and to create it to the pride and astonishment of the whole town, to show what fellows we convicts are. Of course, everything interested them. The costumes, for example. They were awfully curious, for instance, to see a fellow like Vanka Otpeti or Netsvitaev, or Baklushin in different clothes from those in which they had seen them every day for so many years. "Why, he is a convict the same as ever, with the fetters jingling on him, and there he is in a frock coat with a round hat on, in a cloak, like an ordinary person. He's put on moustaches and a wig. Look, he's brought a red handkerchief out of his pocket. He's fanning himself with it. He's acting like a gentleman, for all the world as though he were a gentleman." And everyone was in raptures. The benevolent country gentleman came on in an adjutant's uniform, a very old one, it's true, in epaulettes and a cap with a cockade, and created an extraordinary sensation. There were two competitors for the part, and would you believe it, they quarrelled like children as to which should play it. Both were eager to appear in an adjutant's uniform with shoulder knots. The other actors parted them, and by a majority of votes gave the part to Netsvitaev, not because he was better looking and more presentable than the other, and so looked more like a gentleman, but because Netsvitaev assured them that he would come on with a cane and would wave it about and draw patterns on the ground with it, like a real gentleman, and tip-top swell, which Vanka Otpati could not do, for he had never seen any real gentleman. And indeed, when Netsvitaev came onto the stage with his lady, he kept on rapidly drawing patterns on the floor with a thin, reedy cane which he had picked up somewhere, no doubt considering this a sign of the highest breeding, foppishness and fashion. Probably at some time in his childhood, as a barefoot servant boy, he had happened to see a finely dressed gentleman with a cane, and been fascinated by his dexterity with it, and the impression had remained printed indelibly on his memory, so that now, at 30, he remembered it exactly as it was, for the enchantment and delectation of the whole prison. Netsvitaev was so absorbed in his occupation that he looked at no one. He even spoke without raising his eyes. He simply watched the tip of his cane. The benevolent country lady, too, was a remarkable conception in its way. She came on in a shabby old muslin dress, which looked no better than a rag, with her neck and arms bare, and her face horribly rouged and powdered, with a cotton nightcap tied under her chin, carrying a parasol in one hand and in the other a painted paper fan with which she continually fanned herself. A roar of laughter greeted this lady's appearance. The lady herself could not refrain from laughing several times. A convict called Ivanov took the part. Sirotkin looked very charming, dressed up as a girl. The verses, too, went off very well. In fact, the play gave complete satisfaction to all. There was no criticism, and indeed there could not be.